This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today my guest is Professor David Shields at the University of South Carolina, and he's professor of Southern Letters, but we're not going to talk about literature today. We're going to talk about Southern Provisions, the creation and revival of a cuisine, and it has to do with heritage, grains, and foodstuffs. And so, David, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you so much. It's been a while.
Let's talk a little bit about you. You're professor of Southern Letters, but you're writing about food. But let's talk, you know, who you are, where you're from, you know, the usual Southern thing.
I come from a seven-generation Southern family that grew up in the Chesapeake. I was born in Washington, D.C. because my dad was in the CIA, and I spent the first years of my life in Japan. And curiously enough, I grew up eating Japanese food, not Southern. Indeed, when I came at age five to the United States and had my first bowl of sugar frosted flakes, it was something like shock that I experienced. But my family was originally from the Williamsburg area down in Virginia. I went to the College of William and Mary. Mm-hmm. Was originally a historical archaeologist. And then became increasingly interested in the history of writing. So I've always had fascinations with the material culture, the social culture, and how those sorts of expressions got into written form.
You were in Charleston a while before you came to Columbia and Carolina.
Yes. I spent 20 years at the Citadel before I came to the university here. I've been at the university for a dozen years. It was at the Citadel that my intense interest in food began, and it dates from a period after I got tenure. At that juncture, I guess I decided I didn't want my life to be contained in 6 inches of a library shelf. So I determined that I would develop an expertise for each one of my senses, and they would be separate things entirely. And so I've taken this sort of path where I not only write about Southern literature and early American letters and history, but I've written books about the history of photography. Foodways, of course, is a great interest of mine, and I'm currently and this is for the sense of touch, writing a history of the physical culture movement in America from the first gyms to the bodybuilding period of the 20th century.
Oh, okay. Well, let's focus on your writing about foodways and Southern provisions. And I saw in your book there were some chefs, some of the early chefs in Charleston who, and we're talking about 20th century chefs,
right,
who were rediscovering local ingredients, and that's how you kind of got into this, right?
That's right. Actually, you know, the sort of crisis moment in Charleston cuisine took place in the 90s. John Martin Taylor, mm-hmm. Hoppin' John, wrote mm-hmm. Low Country Cookery, and one of the things he says in there is that we have these recipes, but one of the great problems is that the original ingredients that were used to make these things that required vegetables were no longer grown. And there's a question of whether or not those people who are trying to make dishes out of Charleston receipts are performing a kind of charade because the tastes aren't there.
Let's get into that. I mean, the most obvious one is rice.
That's right.
Carolina gold rice, which was the grain that was used for centuries.
Last commercially grown in about World War I. Hurricanes destroyed the last commercial fields. I guess individuals planted small plots until the 1950s. But yes, how can you have a rice kitchen or a rice-based cuisine without the original rice, and particularly a rice that was so famous that in the 1850s, the long grain version of it commanded the highest price on the world rice market in Paris.
Yeah, and it won the gold medals. As you say, it was the gold standard.
And for low country cooking, it's absolutely necessary. The taste of this rice is quite extraordinary. It has this bloom of starch that communicates wholesomeness. It's a non-aromatic rice, so it isn't really sharply pronounced, but it has a sort of hazelnutty
taste. I was going to say it has a nutty taste, and because of people like Glenn Roberts at Anson Mills, and interestingly, Glenn was one of the first guests we had on the show. I bumped into him in Five Points and got a tour of the early version of Anson Mills, and he gave me some Carolina Gold rice, and it the taste is just, it's not Uncle Ben's converted rice.
Oh, of course not. I mean, but I'm sure that nowadays the taste is familiar to anyone who's been in a restaurant in the South, because when we brought that back a dozen years ago, it was universally adopted and everyone recognized that this was the missing ingredient. It has this extraordinary capacity to marry flavors. And if you're having one pot dishes, these West African dishes, which are so central to low country cuisine, it's the necessary background for all of those other flavors.
So, and it's not just the West African, it's also the French, the Huguenot, the Perlots, the...
Right, exactly. You know, there is this discussion of an Italian influence as well in some of the early rice culture in the low country. But the dishes, a lot of them are from around the Mediterranean.
You mentioned the Italian because we do know this goes back to the demographics and who was here. And since there are three language areas in Switzerland which furnished immigrants to South Carolina, when I wrote the history in 1998, obviously we've got French and we've got German. I could never find Italian. I found some Swedes. I found, you know, others. But since then, I have been told by colleagues that, yes, there were Italian Swiss who came over here. I'm not totally convinced of all of that. But, I mean, you do have the three language areas in Switzerland, which provided a large number of non-English immigrants to colonial South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Trying to track all of those influences is an extraordinary thing when you're dealing with low country cooking, because it is such a melange of cultural influences from the Native American sweet potatoes and squash and beans and corn to the European cattle and the livestock and fruits.
And the vegetables.
Yes, and the vegetables coming from everywhere.
Yeah. Now, you were talking about Hop and John and the rice. It wasn't just the rice, but he also researched and found heritage corn to produce grits and cornmeal.
That's right. Originally, the mill, which he founded in the 90s, mm-hmm. Was based on corn, including a field that he had purchased from a bootlegger, interestingly enough, of John Hawk, I think, is the corn variety. And then he decided that the rice had to be brought back. And it was at that juncture that his path and mine crossed. I had put together a meeting in 2002, 2003 with Natalie Dupree and a few other mm-hmm. people. Devoted to the cuisines of the Low Country and the Caribbean. And we brought in chefs and historians and producers. And it was an interesting conversation. But afterwards, Glenn came up to me and said, "I wish it was a cuisine. But, you know, a cuisine is an expression of a growing system. And none of the stuff that made up our cooking now grows here. I want to bring it back. The problem is we have lost or forgotten so much that we don't know what to bring back other than the rice." And he said, "You do research. Can you help me?" And so I spent 3 years reading 19th century ag journals in the basement of the Thomas Cooper Library, some on microfilm, trying to find out what the co-crops were, the provision crops, the rotation crops, and the entire rationale for putting together all of these ingredients that would come to make up low country cuisine. And at the end of the 3 years, we had a list of the essential things that were needful that we wanted to bring it back. And that's one of the things which sort of distinguishes our effort from that of other restorationists like the Native Seed Search in the Southwest. You know, ethnobotanical serendipity, the discovery of, a chance old bean growing in someone's yard, you know, is the thing which thrills seed savers there. But for us, we knew the names of the enduring linchpin ingredients of the system and went out looking for them one by one. And if we couldn't find them, we would backbreed them into existence.
I'm sure for some listeners, David, this is going to sound like Jurassic Park.
Oh, yes. but, you know, the thing you want is the taste. And the reason why this cuisine was celebrated, because everyone, every visitor who came to the Lowcountry and sat down for a Lowcountry meal, whether it was high-end or low-end, it was always something that was distinctive, something that inspired great pleasure, and something that caused people to reflect about the differences in what made this type of food distinctive.
You've got a list of when certain things were introduced.
That's in chapter 2, yes. It's several pages long of the various garden vegetables.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating just to see where the seed came from. Originally, much of it from Europe until the 1830s. Mm-hmm. And then the Horticultural Society organizes, and they begin a contest. And the contest is held at their annual exhibition. But if you had provided vegetables to the market that were considered superlative, they too were considered. And the winners of the contest became the seedsmen for that variety. So you had this situation where in the 1830s, all of a sudden, Southerners are taking control of the seed and policing it in such a way and making the best products available to the market. And that's one of the things which everyone talks about when they come to the Charleston market in the antebellum period. Superlative vegetables, extraordinary fruit. Curiously enough, the fish is not something which is commended, and the meat is seasonal. Summertime, you don't want to be buying beef, but in wintertime, you might be.
Yeah. David, I referred to your book, and of course, I want to remind our listeners that we're talking about the title Southern Provisions, the creation and revival of a cuisine. That's where the list is.
That's right.
And you're talking about the Horticultural Society, but also prior to 1861, of the great nurseries of the American South was up at Pomerio, William Sumner.
William Sumner and Adam Sumner, his brother, were the two great pomologists, and Adam Sumner was also a great breeder of cattle. There's a professor, his name's James Kibler, who's now writing the biography of both men. Mm-hmm. And we tend to think of P.J. Berkmans of Augusta, Georgia, the head of Fruitlands, as the premier breeder of fruit in the South in the 19th century. But it's actually the Summers brothers who produce more, and with a wider range of horticultural and agricultural and arboreal productions than anyone else. The thing is that Adam Sumner was a literary figure, but William was not. In the post-bellum period, Adam went down to Florida to import Brahmin cattle and sort of begin the new age of ranching down in Florida, while William continues on breeding peaches and pears and plums. They imported for the first time many trees from various parts of the world. And trees are long-lived entities. So when Professor Kibler managed to get a hold of the account books of William Sumner, he decided to go to the sites of the people who bought the trees and found a tremendous number of them still survive. And he has cuttings of them up in his his plantation up in Whitmire.
I read through the list of some of the things that they developed, and among the things that they developed were any number of variety of apples.
Right.
Pears.
Right.
Peaches.
Nectarines and crab apples. We neglect the crab apple now, but if you're going to make really good cider, you have to have that sharp top note, which the crab apple supplies.
Yeah. And some of them bore the name Pomeria, Pomeria greening apple, Pomeria gauge plum, Pomeria seedling strawberry,
right.
Pomeria hebe pear. But others didn't. The peaches were named for the poinsettes.
That's it.
Poinsett, the poinsett peach, and the Mrs. Poinsett peach. Yeah. I don't know the difference, but I mean, that's the way they were advertised.
And there's a Bachman pear, too, recognizing the great biologist in Charleston. One of the things that we have to say about the fruits is that when a new fruit comes on, you often had the trunk of an old fruit stripped down and the new fruit grafted on. We may have a situation where your Bachman pears and other things exist only as a trunk, and the actual fruiting part of the tree may be these grafted later limbs of Alberta peaches or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's dealing with fruit is a really interesting thing, trying to parse out what you've got when you're looking at a tree in an ancient orchard.
I look forward to you and to your and Jim Kibler's research on that. But let's talk about, for example, cabbages. You said there were 30 different kinds of cabbages.
That's right. And one of the things that we have to think about, the collard, which is only relatively recently became a seeded item that appeared in seed catalogs about the 1870s, actually developed out of heading varieties that had been imported but would not head in the southern climate, so that they formed these open leaf forms. And what happened, those were called coleworts in the early part of the 19th century. And people liked the taste of some of those so much that they decided to just grow them as brassicas that form only in leaf, and the colewort became the collard over the course of the 19th century. And I guess the Georgia bluestem, which is that very sturdy collard that if you don't cook it enough is like chewing on an old rubber boot or something like that, is the first variety that we know. But the collards developed into numbers of varieties, and some, like the yellow cabbage collard that developed in eastern North Carolina, is a wonderfully tender and flavorful collard. They make a collard pickle up there that's sort of like North Carolina kimchi. They have these hot peppers Aden, North Carolina, is the sort of ground zero of the yellow cabbage collard.
Well, once upon a time we had a collard fest here in South Carolina, actually in Gaston, but it has disappeared. So what you're really saying is the collard that everybody thinks is very traditional for generations, it's a 19th century.
19th century plant, and buying seeds for collards is something which has only been since the 1870s.
Okay. But I'm still trying to get over the idea of 30 varieties of cabbages.
Well, the cabbages always had a fascination in South Carolina, and the great day of the cabbage was actually the early 20th century when all of James Island was planted in cabbage. The cabbage boom with its cabbage king. There was boxcars that sent off cabbages to New York and Philadelphia. And it was the last gasp of the great age of truck farming that began after the Civil War and continued till World War I. Nowadays, we tend to think of California as the great center of vegetable production, but for the, you know, half a century after the Civil War, the Charleston Neck was perhaps the greatest and most diverse vegetable-producing region in the South, and portions of Tidewater, Virginia, all the way down to Georgia and parts of the Gulf Coast were also truck farming. They're wonderful descriptions of of men harvesting cabbages, where they would walk down the rows with these two machetes doing cross strokes, beheading the cabbages with teenage boys picking up the heads as they roll off the guillotine, you know, sticking them into the baskets. But the variety that was grown was the Charleston Wakefield cabbage, which was a wonderful cabbage for coleslaw. They also grew the flat Dutch cabbage, which was a sauerkraut cabbage. But well, one of the things to think about, you know, now that drought is affecting the vegetable industry in California, where will the vegetables be grown? Well, you may have heard that in the last 6 months, these California growers have been buying up land in South Carolina along I-95. They're looking at the places which were the great vegetable growing areas before the troubles in California.
Yeah.
When we did our recovery or analysis of the field crops and the co-crops and rotations, we discovered that, for instance, Bene, the low-oil sesame that came out of West Africa, was extensively grown, and it's a weed suppressor. So allotropic. So it was intercropped with other things that, you know, had suffered from weed problems. And Bene is a very fascinating plant because it supplied something that was very difficult to get in the South, which was culinary oil. After the many failed attempts to grow olives mm-hmm. in the Southeast, the problem of importing olive oil as a salad oil, the most popular lipid was lard. So beginning in about 1810, the governor of Georgia decides that he's going to press Bene seed. And the taste of Bene oil is wonderful. Now, when we consume sesame oil now, we tend to think of those rather pungent bottles of Asian sesame oil. Well, that's parched seeds that make this oil. In the 19th century, it was cold pressed. The quality of the oil is spectacular. It has a high smoke point, so you can use it for frying. It has a virtually immortal shelf life. It's chock full of antioxidants, so it will keep you from all sorts of diseases. When we brought Bene back, we discovered that when you press the oil out of the seed, it leaves Bene cake. In the 19th century, some of it was fed to cattle, but we found it mills up and it has a wonderful flour quality. If you want the special ingredient for your southern biscuits or bread, put in that Bene cake and it will be tremendous.
All right. David, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor David Shields of the University of South Carolina about his book, Southern Provisions, The Creation and Revival of a Cuisine. I just got back from visiting friends in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Thorne Compton. He and his Columbia-born wife, Raven McCrory, live there, and there is a very nice place that they took us to. We would have said down here, a meet in three, Zingerman's.
Oh, yes. The people that revived the rice waffle.
Yes. And on the menu were South Carolina grits, Anson Mill, and grits up there in their retail store are over $10 a pound.
Oh, that's extraordinary.
Well, those Michiganders seem to really like the products. I mean, the grits, the rice.
Yes, and the chef there, Ari, won the James Beard Award as a result of these workings with these low country ingredients. There are many chefs all across the United States that use these ingredients that were brought back by Glenn Roberts and the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation, this nonprofit group that organized about 2004 to do the research and to actually get into commercial production these restored ingredients. And Bene was the first, but Sea Island red peas were one of the things we've discovered. Several varieties of corn. One of the most surprising things that we found out was that along the coast, a white flint corn was grown. We tend to think of southern corns being dent corns, the cornmeal corns from the upcountry. Mm-hmm. But along the coast, there was this very hard, high starch, high sugar corn, and it grows all the way down to Florida. And it was preserved in the USDA gene banks. An agent in 1905 came to Edisto Island, collected some. So when we found the written evidence that this was considered the premium corn for making grits out of, we asked the USDA to supply us some, and we have been bringing that back.
All right. Now, how do you go about – do you have to get somebody to grow this? And growing heritage crops is not as easy as growing the modern genetically modified.
Oh, that's right. You have to think that these plants evolved and were developed by farmers over hundreds of generations in some instances in situations that didn't have regular irrigation. So they're very drought tolerant. They're not as productive as modern plants. They have enormous root systems, and that gives them a tremendous capacity to take out nutritional vegetables from the soil. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at a modern GMO plant, it has a very cursory root system, which is good enough to take all the petroleum-based fertilizer and turn it into plant material. But these old plants, if you feed them modern fertilizer, will grow up 15 feet tall, and the first sharp wind will knock them over and they'll lodge. So you can't grow them that way. We have a collaborator in our efforts, Dr. Brian Ward from Clemson, who works down in CREC in Charleston, who does the initial growouts of all of these things that we bring back. And he's the person that brought the 20 surviving peanuts from the ancestral peanut of the South that we rediscovered. That's the Carolina African peanut. We found that 3 years ago in Dr. Eislab's.
Where did you find it?
Dr. Tom Eislab, who's a peanut breeder up in North Carolina State, I called him up and asked whether he had any peanuts that were labeled either Carolina or African. And he said, yes, these may have been collected back in the 1930s or 40s, and, they're part of the germplasm for their peanut breeding system. We have a Carolina 4 and a Carolina 8, and they sent 20 from their freezer where they kept them, and 16 of the Carolina 4 plants survived. They were the one. We had these descriptions of the weight, the size, the configuration. The Carolina 8 was not the one. Mm. And so he has been bulking it up. So now he has 60,000 seed peanuts ready for release that will be put into the hands of farmers for cultivation.
So you have farmers who want to do this now?
Yes. These ingredients command premium prices because they're so storied and so legendary. Mm-hmm. They have a taste which is absolutely distinctive. In the case of this peanut, it's the oil quality which is so superlative to it. This was the version that was sent over to the Royal Society in the 18th century from around Wilmington, mm-hmm. North Carolina, and one consumed in London was said this was the equal of Tuscan oil. And throughout the 19th century, France bought up lots of the peanuts from North Carolina to make Castile soap with. And the other thing that it does well, if you parch it and make it into peanut meal, it cooks up with this extraordinarily deep, rich, nutty taste. Now, a lot of people have grown up with a Virginia peanut. The taste of the Virginia, even when roasted, which is the way that most people consume it, is not quite as profound or rich. And you have to realize that what happened was there were these growers from southern part of Virginia in the 1840s who were jealous of North Carolinians getting the entire peanut market, including the very robust New York street side roasted peanut market. So they went down to Bolivia, which was one of the homes of the peanut. Peanuts are natively South American. And curiously enough, they go to Africa in the 16th century relatively early and then come back to North America that way. But the Virginians went straight to the source, to Bolivia, and they said, we want you to find the biggest peanut that you can find. They had reckoned that the people who drive the peanut market in New York were 10-year-old boys, you know, like street urchins who would buy these things. And the thing they wanted was the biggest darn peanut, a peanut the size of your thumb, you know.
Yeah.
And so they found it and they brought it back. And there's the history of your Virginia peanut.
All right. Well, let me ask you, the Carolina peanut that is now going to be produced, how does that taste in the one of the traditional ways here, boiled peanuts?
Tastes wonderful. It's the original boiled peanut. The dish that I actually want to taste in conjunction with this is the famous Charleston signature candy, the groundnut cake. You know, from the 18 teens until they were shut down in the World War I, the groundnut cake ladies were on every street corner, and it was everyone, every little Charlestonian kid loved the groundnut cake, which was this molasses and parched peanut cake, which was very tasty and pungent, a little lemon added to it. And the Lee brothers, who I'm sure that you know, do a version of this, but they're using a modern peanut.
One of the things you mentioned in your book, David, is you're concerned about the ingredient itself. You're not concerned as much about how people use it. You want them to get the taste. And so whether they actually do 18th century Hoppin' John is fine, but you don't mind them taking that 18th century vegetable now and or rice and doing something else.
No, that's exactly the case. The importance is the taste of the ingredient. What made Low Country cuisine and a lot of Southern cuisine important was the quality of the vegetable or the grain. And back then, when these now landmark dishes were made, people were experimenting with what was grown here that may have been unfamiliar. You know, an African-American cook doesn't know the fruits that came from mm-hmm. Europe or whatever. And the taste guides them. Mm-hmm. And what you need for chefs now is the taste. You don't need a template for how to do it. Sure, if you want to make a pine bark stew or a Hoppin' John, it'd be great to use the classic ingredients, Sea Island red peas and Carolina gold rice. But you can make that Carolina gold rice, and those red peas do so much more.
Some of your best friends have written cookbooks, but you're kind of dismissive of cookbooks.
Well, I'm dismissive. I don't want to sound like the enemy of the cookbooks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've already mentioned the Lee brothers and Natalie Dupree, who we've had on the show, and we've talked about their cookbooks.
And Sean Brock, who was a very close collaborator.
Down at Husk, yeah.
And Linton Hopkins down in Atlanta, Georgia. Originally, this book existed as a set of manuscript bulletins which circulated for numbers of years among chefs exclusively. I had no intention of writing a book when I first began these things. I thought that the project was to bring back the ingredients. But more and more, I realized that the rationale for the revival, the explanation of what is at stake in terms of the flavor, the entire pattern, and understanding the history of Southern cooking, and recovering something like the professional dimension of the creation of the cuisine. There's an awful lot of stress on home cooking in the South, mm-hmm. but the South has benefited from eight generations of exquisitely trained professional chefs, Anglo-American, Franco-American, African-American, and I wanted to get their contributions in terms of the framing of this cuisine as well. So that's in here also. So that decided me on switching from manuscript notes to an actual manuscript like this.
You talked about circulating the manuscript. The Southern Foodways Alliance, of which you were one of the founding members, John T. Edge.
Yeah. I was actually a latter-day member, but it is the great network for documenting and celebrating Southern food. And John Egerton was he was the founding genius. A group that's as much interested in the social justice dimensions of food as it is in terms of the food itself. And that's one of the hallmarks of they want to make sure that the farmer gets recognized. They want to make sure that the labor of those people who cook things is always acknowledged. And that's important. Southern Provisions, while it treats cooks and chefs, is more focused on the ingredients themselves and their story because it's one of the dimensions that the Southern Foodways has not really paid mm-hmm. much attention to, with the exception of barbecue.
Yeah.
And so this is a kind of complementary inquiry to the Southern Foodways. Now, I wanted to get back to the question of why I had certain trepidations about using cookbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think about it like this. Cookbooks, when they give a recipe for something, they'll say, cut up one squash, cut up an onion, salt, pepper, cook 1/2 hour. Well, in the 19th century, there were 35 to maybe 38 different varieties of squash created over the course of that century. Which squash is the best for that? And that's never spoken of. There is a knowledge that chefs have, and even really good home cooks, about, well, is this a patty pan or a Hubbard that I should use? Oh, a long neck winter squash. Maybe I should use one of those Kushaw squashes. I mean, the Southerners have a multitude of squashes at their disposal. And the cookbook is always quite reticent because maybe the home cook doesn't have that variety of squash at her disposal. And cookbook writers don't want the users of the cookbook to feel anxiety. So they make the most generic kind of designation of ingredients. There's only one cookbook in the 19th century that documented that really profound, deep knowledge of vegetable varieties. It was written by Jules Arthur Harder, who actually spent a year in Savannah in 1872, but he was a chef at Delmonico's in New York and a chef at the Union Club, and most importantly, a chef at the Palace Hotel restaurant in San Francisco. And it was he that got the California farmers to grow high-end vegetables, and he inspired the California takeover of the vegetable world. But he published a book called The Physiology of Taste, or Harder's Practical American Cookery, borrowed Brillet-Savarin's title there, and published it himself in 1885.
Okay. Well, what squash would somebody, let's just say, in the Midlands, I don't like that term. I like the 19th century term, middle country, much better.
Right.
But let's just say some of those good German folk in Orangeburg County, what squash would they might have been, what would they have been growing in the 19th century?
They would have been growing the patty pan squash, the one that sort of looks like a pentagon. Yeah, that's right. Or is it six-sided? I forget exactly. They would have also grown a winter squash for pie making.
Mm-hmm.
After 1925, when the Cherokees released the candy roaster squash, which the Cherokee had been sort of perfecting over the course of the 19th century. And in 25 at the Indian Fair, they brought that out, and it became a regional sensation. North Georgians, Kentuckians, and people all the way down to Orangeburg started growing that because it was a versatile squash and had this really wonderful taste when it caramelized.
Is it grown now?
Yes. You can get it from all sorts of seed sources. The Southern Seed Savers Exchange.
So we're not talking about that the yellow crookneck squash that you buy in the grocery store.
Oh, you can, yes. This is a different thing. The yellow crookneck squash is good if you know, boil it up with onions and some butter and some salt and pepper. That's a classic summer squash.
Yeah.
Who's saying anything against that? We're dealing with just the deeper and profounder flavors. And if you want to have a richer experience at the table, that's the way to go.
Yeah. You mentioned that the high point of Southern cuisine was actually post-Civil War.
Yes. Despite all of the, the celebration of the civilization of antebellum South in terms of the table culture, the greatest achievements of Southern cuisine in terms of ingredients available is actually during Reconstruction. And the reason why is because when the Southern economy turns to truck farming, instead of the production of a staple like cotton or rice or something like that for its economic survival, all of a sudden you have all of these vegetables being grown that were not grown with a plentitude which enabled even the poorest people to have a wealth of vegetables and fruits in their grasp. The other thing that happens is that fish in low country become much more diverse in market. There were only six or seven varieties available during the antebellum period, largely because Yankees controlled the fishing fleet. But a man named Charles C. Leslie, an African-American, takes over the fish market in Charleston after the war. And he's kind of an amateur ichthyologist. He goes collecting fish and sends them off to professors and becomes something of a celebrity in fish collection circles. And he expands what's available at the market from six to maybe 35 or 36 fishes regularly available. Even now, we have nowhere near the plentitude that he made regularly apparent on that fish market down off of East Bay. He actually engineered the takeover of the fishing fleets by South Carolinians. One of the things which interests me particularly about Leslie is that since he had given many specimens to these professors, he wanted something in return, so asked for information about whether soft-shell crabs could be farmed. And several of these people said, well, yes, they could if you set up an arrangement like this. So Leslie creates the first soft-shell crab farm in the South over in Mount Pleasant. And soft-shell crabs are available to Charlestonians from, I guess May into the early reaches of August. With a greater availability than any place else in the United States.
Wow.
One of the things you're probably interested in is where do we go from here?
Absolutely.
One of the things we have to realize is just how successful we've been in terms of the restoration. We've brought back the Sea Island White Flint corn that I was talking to you about. We brought back the greatest antebellum watermelon.
The Bradford watermelon?
That's right. It's a fascinating story created by Nathaniel Napoleon Bradford in the 1840s and 50s. And this man creates this watermelon. It tastes superb. The rattlesnake is created also at the same time in Georgia using the Lawson and another cross. And here are the two great watermelons of the South, the South Carolina one and the North Carolina one. There's a problem with the Bradford in terms of truck farming. It has a very tender rind, which of course is makes it superb for rind pickles. Mm-hmm. But if you stack them more than two deep in a boxcar, they crack. So you can't ship them to the North. So these watermelon breeders say, well, let's cross these things with a scaly bark, which is a watermelon has a rind of a rhino hide. And they create this Kolb's Gem watermelon, which you can stack five deep in a boxcar. It doesn't taste anywhere near as good as a Georgia rattlesnake or a Bradford melon. But heck, you know, Yankees are buying it, so who cares? We've got the Bradfords for our own backyard. Mm-hmm. So what happens, strangely enough, is that the market begins to dominate things. And fewer Bradfords are raised. And then disease crops up because of monoculture. In the 1890s, Fusarium wilt shows up. Entire counties worth of watermelons die over the course of 2 weeks in Georgia. And all of a sudden, among watermelon growers, the panic occurs. We have to get a watermelon that is resistant to Fusarium wilt. That also is a shipping melon. And so you can see the Bradford being increasingly marginalized. The last known commercial crops in the 1920s, despite the fact that it tastes better than any of the resistant or shipping melons. I thought it was completely gone. And I wrote a lament for the loss of the South's great watermelon. And I posted it up on the internet as part of my American Heritage Vegetable website at the University of South Carolina. 2 a.m. in the morning, a man from Sumter apparently came across it and writes me an email. He says, "My name is Nat Bradford. I've been growing the Bradford watermelon down here in this patch in Sumter. We've been growing it in our family for eight generations." So it survived, and we brought it back. And one of the things that we realized when we brought it back was it's going to be a tough sell to get the mass public to buy a 30-pound picnic melon with seeds in it. Mm-hmm. Everyone grows these seedless refrigerator melons because of their great convenience. Mm-hmm. So we decided that we would have to revive the 19th century ancillary foods that were associated. Watermelon molasses, spectacular tasting thing. When chefs first tasted that, and they realized that they could make this themselves relatively easily, it was like a light bulb going off.
But obviously, this is something that, let's just say, can our friend Geechee Boy, can he grow those and then for the Charleston market?
So yes.
So that, I mean, basically the shipping, it's not much of an issue.
That's right.
So it has to be grown
locally. That's right.
Yeah. What's the range of those all throughout the South? Or?
Now, the seed has been made available in the last 2 years by Nat Bradford, and people are growing it from Virginia down into North Florida now. He himself has the Bradford Watermelon Company, and he makes rind pickle. He makes watermelon molasses, then there's watermelon brandy. We convinced Scott Blackwell of High Wire Distillery to revive that 19th century U de V, and 100 and some bottles were made, and they were snapped up. And a second version of this is being made by a 20 and 6 distillery up in the northern part of the state.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Mr. Bradford is he's actually an architect, isn't he?
He is. He's a graduate of Clemson, but he is he does ecological, edible landscape gardens and gardens that use largely native plants.
David, I hate to do this, but I'm getting the wind-up sign. I want to thank you for being with us today on the Journal. But before we sign off, any last words for our listeners?
Things to take a look for in the future. This last year, we discovered the original whiskey, biscuit, and cake flour wheat of the South, purple straw wheat. And we've started growing that out. It would be fascinating to have the taste of this variety of wheat that was apparently grown from early in the colonial period to 1970s throughout the South. There are only two wheats, that and the Red May, which are have been on the land throughout that entire time.
Okay. Well, David Shields, the author of Southern Provisions, The Creation and Revival of a Cuisine, thanks for being with us today on the Journal.
I'm glad to have been here.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know I did. I really learned something not only by reading the book, Southern Provisions by David Shields, but also by talking with him. When I started off the show, I said it's a Jurassic Park of the vegetable world. It really is. DNA or germplasm from here for there, finding what everybody thought was an extinct plant and bringing it back to the market so that we in the 21st century can have the wonderful taste experiences that literally generations of Southerners had once upon a time. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.